Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Tonight's class is the Book of Daniel of Daniel. It has a very close affinity for me. Now, as with the Book of Yechezkel, this is something that I taught weekly here in Beth Jacob. This was more recent, and it's a 12-chapter book, and it took us the better part of a year to do. Those classes are available online at TorahMediaAtlanta.com, and if you want a more in-depth discussion of Daniel, and after tonight I am sure you're going to want a more in-depth discussion of Daniel, you're welcome to listen online to those classes. Daniel is one of the most difficult books in all of Tanakh because... Did someone else say that about a different book?
Yes.
Sorry. Daniel is a fairly easy book to read, actually. Bedtime reading at its best. Keep it on your nightstand. The difficulty with Daniel is because there is a lot in Daniel that is about the coming of Mashiach and the future. And as a result, there's a lot of things in Daniel that are used by other religions to justify their own positions. The purpose tonight is not to go through those specific verses, but instead to go get an overview of the entire book and to talk about who Daniel was. But the theme of Mashiach, of the Messiah, and Daniel is actually very important because the Gemara has a discussion, the Talmud has a discussion regarding Mashiach. There is a common misconception that Mashiach must come from someone who is alive today. And that is most likely the case. You would think Mashiach is going to come from someone who is alive when Mashiach is a flesh and blood person. He's the king. He's a descendant of King David. And he will restore the monarchy for the Jewish people. And so we're talking about a regular person. But the Gemara, when discussing who Mashiach might be, the Gemara says that, well, if you want an example of someone who, in the time of the Talmud, was currently alive, who is a descendant of King David and may be someone who could theoretically be Mashiach, and it lists one of the sages of the Talmud and says that this person could theoretically be Mashiach. Then the Gemara says, and if Mashiach comes from someone who has already passed away, then a good example, a good guess, would be Daniel. Daniel was a direct descendant of King David, and the Gemara lists Daniel as the prime candidate from those who have already passed away. So what does that mean? How could Mashiach come from someone who's passed away? Because Hashem could always bring a person back to life, and that person could be Mashiach. It can happen. We don't know what's going to happen, but the point that we need to understand from this is that Daniel in his day was someone who was fit for monarchy. The problem was that he couldn't be king because we were in exile, because the monarchy had ceased for the Jewish people at that time. So Daniel was almost like our monarch in exile. Daniel represents the Davidic line in exile. It is by no coincidence that Daniel will regularly rise to being the prime advisor to the king, the second in command, the one who the king gives over tremendous responsibility to, because really Daniel is fit to be king. He ought to be king, but he can't be king because we're not in our own country at the time that he lives. So with that backdrop, let's go through the story of Daniel. Now you have in front of you one sheet of paper, and that is the timeline for the book of Daniel. Now this timeline really begins from the rise of power of Nebuchadnezzar, who is the king of Babylonia, who destroys the first temple, and goes all the way to the construction of the second temple, at least to when the construction begins to happen or resumes. I'd like to take a few moments now to go through the timeline without a focus on the book of Daniel, but rather just to go through the timeline to understand it, because it too becomes a significant backdrop to the book itself. It's important to know that the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, of the first temple, took place in stages. It didn't happen all at once. There were successive conquests of Israel by Nebuchadnezzar, by the Babylonian king, that slowly but surely brought the temple to its end, to its destruction. Nebuchadnezzar, as you see in the timeline, comes to power in the Jewish year 3319, which corresponds to 441 before the Common Era. The corresponding date is not necessarily perfect. We're not really sure of the exact dates, but that's a good ballpark figure. So it's 3319 from the creation of the world, from how we count. The second year of his reign, he conquers Israel. Now at that time, the king of Israel was Jehoiakim. He was the king. And Nebuchadnezzar conquered him and made him into a puppet king. He made him pay tribute to Babylonia. And essentially, the Jewish state was now under the control of Nebuchadnezzar, as was the rest of the known world. Nebuchadnezzar was an incredibly powerful person. He ruled alone. He didn't even really use advisors. And he conquered the entire known world. There was a period of time over the next 6 years where Nebuchadnezzar had where Jehoiakim was serving Nebuchadnezzar. Then there was a rebellion. Nebuchadnezzar came back and quelled the rebellion. He ended up killing Jehoiakim, putting Jehoiakim's son in place as his king, returning to Babylonia, and then coming back and conquering the son of Jehoiakim, and this time causing the first real exile. The son of Jehoiakim has really two names. It's really the same name, but it's expressed two different ways. One is Yechaniah, and that's the way I have it for you on the third of the timeline charts here, 3327, exile of Yechaniah. He's also known as Jehoiakim. Now you may be familiar with the name Yechaniah, because his name comes up in the book of Esther. In the Gilas Esther, which we read every Purim, Yechaniah's name comes up. Does anybody know where Yechaniah's name comes up in the book of Esther? No. But Yechaniah comes up when Mordechai is first mentioned. You know how the reader gets to the verse of Mordechai, and everybody reads that verse. Ish Yehudi Hayah B'Shushan Habira. There was a Jew in Shushan, the capital. Everybody reads that together. And then the reader reads the verse again. And then he moves into a tune that is really for the book of Eicha, a mournful tune. And he says about Mordechai, Asher Haglam Yerushalayim, that Mordechai had been taken into exile from Jerusalem. Im Hagola Asher Haglissa, with the exile that had been exiled, im with Yechaniah Melech Yehuda, with Yechaniah the king of Yehuda. So Mordechai was taken into exile with that exile that went into exile with Yechaniah the king of Yehuda. It's very wordy. Just say Mordechai was taken into exile. Why does the author of the Megillah need to tell us that Mordechai went into exile with that exile that went with Yechaniah the king of Yehuda? That's because with the destruction of the first temple, there were actually two exiles, and they were 11 years apart. Yechaniah, who was the son of Jehoiakim, when Yechaniah was king, Nebuchadnezzar had finally had enough of that line of the Davidic reign, And he came and took Yechonya into exile. But he didn't destroy the temple. He took Yechonya into exile, and instead he appointed as king Tzidkiyahu. Tzidkiyahu was the uncle of Yechonya, also from the Davidic line, but he wasn't a son, he was an uncle of Yechonya. So he took Yechonya into exile, and he left Tzidkiyahu in charge. That went on for another 11 years, at which point Nebuchadnezzar came back, destroyed the temple, and took the rest of the people into exile. When he took Yechonya into exile, which is called Galus Yechonya, the exile of Yechonya, when that happened, he took along with Yechonya all of the leadership of the Jewish people, the sages, the leaders, all those who would have been those who could direct the people and possibly cause a rebellion. Nebuchadnezzar took all those people with him into exile. The notable exception was Yirmiyahu, was Jeremiah. Yirmiyahu he left behind in Israel. But with the exception of Yirmiyahu, of Jeremiah, the rest of the leaders of the Jewish people were taken into exile 11 years prior to the destruction of the temple. Included in this list of great people were Mordechai of the Purim story, and that's why his name is mentioned with Yechonya when he's introduced in the Megillah. Included was also Yechezkel, Ezekiel, who we learned about several weeks ago. And included in this group were Daniel, our hero for tonight, and his three friends, who also get the spotlight tonight, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were friends of Daniel, and those four were taken 11 years prior to the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. They were dragged to Babylonia. They were young at the time. Exactly how old they were, I don't know. It could be that it is written somewhere, but I'm not familiar with exactly how old they were. But they were young. Teenagers, perhaps. They were young men. When they got to Babylonia, they were groomed to be in the court of the king. Not to be close to the king, but to be in the court of the king. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, all of whom were descendants of the Davidic line. Daniel was definitely a descendant of the Davidic line. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, there's a difference of opinion in the Talmud whether they were or weren't, but they were certainly of the leadership of the Jewish people, meaning groomed to be leaders. So that happens in the year 3327, which corresponds to 433 before the Common Era. And the great people of the Jewish people were taken into exile. 11 years later is when Tzidkiyahu was defeated by Nebuchadnezzar, the Beis HaMikdash was burnt to the ground, and all the rest of the people were dragged to Babylonia. And here we have an incredible and notable difference between what happened with the Babylonian exile and what happened for us here in the United States of America. When the first Jews came to the United States of America, the Jews who came were immigrants, were looking for a better life. It wasn't the leadership of the Jewish people, it was regular Jews. And when they came to America, there were certain elements necessary for Jewish life that had not yet been established. For example, there were no shuls, there were no schools, there were no mikvahs, there was no kosher food, there were no eruvs, there were no pizza shops. No. But there were all of the elements necessary for Jewish life were not yet established in America. The people who came over therefore found themselves in a brand new culture without that anchor of the Jewish life, of that which we hold dear, which keeps us moving in our Jewish adherence for our religion, for everything. And so it was difficult to avoid assimilation. But when Hashem caused the destruction of the first temple because of our sins, He did it in a merciful way, in that the leadership of the people was taken 11 years before the destruction. So when Mordechai, Yechezkel, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, when they got to Babylonia, they got to Babel, they immediately set about establishing those necessary components for Jewish life. They set up shuls, they set up schools, they set up mikvahs, they set up eruvs, they set up kosher food. 11 years later, when their brethren who had been left behind in Israel, when they were dragged to Babylonia in chains and in tears, but they came and found a thriving Jewish community to which they were welcomed with open arms and were able to prosper and grow in Babylonia. This was a chesed, this was a kindness that God did in the midst of the destruction, that there was at least this element of being able to save the Jews, that our culture remained the same, we were able to practice our religion, we didn't get swallowed up by the Babylonian culture. Time went on in Babylonia, in Babel. In 3363, Nebuchadnezzar dies and he's succeeded by his son Evil-Merodach. Ironically, in English that would be evil. But that was his son. And then in 3386, Evil-Merodach dies. And Belshazzar was another son of Nebuchadnezzar. He was a brother, or a half-brother, of Evil-Merodach. And he becomes king. And then, in the third year of his reign, in 3389, comes the famous party of Belshazzar and the story of the handwriting on the wall. If we're learning the book of Daniel, of course we must talk about the handwriting of the wall, and we will get to that, please God, later on this evening. That happens in that year. Then the alliance of the Medes and the Persians conquers Babylonia. Belshazzar is killed, and Dariavish the Mede becomes king over what used to be the Babylonian Empire. It is now the Persian Mede Empire. And he becomes king. And during his reign, which only lasted a year, that's the famous story of Daniel in the lion's den. And of course, how could we talk about Daniel without discussing the lion's den? And we'll get to that as well. In 3390, Dariavish himself is killed in battle. And his son-in-law Koresh, who is a Persian, he becomes king. And then he is the one who announces that there can be a rebuilding of the temple. He has an idea that God made him king in order that he could now bring about the construction of the second temple. And he gives permission for the Jews to leave Babylonia, go back to Israel, and rebuild the temple. The Jews go back. Here we already move into books that you haven't learned about yet. No, that's not true. You did learn about them already. Excuse me. Here we get into the books of... No? Excuse me. Sorry, again. You didn't learn about them yet. Of Nehemiah and Ezra, where they are part of the people who are going to go back. And they begin to rebuild the second to construct the second temple. In 3393, that rebuilding of the temple is stopped because the enemies of the Jews tell the king that the Jews are trying to rebel, and they manage to convince him that that's the case, so the building is stopped. In that year, Koresh dies, Ahasuerus, the famous Ahasuerus of the Purim story, becomes king, and 3 years later is when the Purim story begins with the party of Ahasuerus. Now I want to call your attention to the party of Ahasuerus in which Vashti is killed, and the party of Belshazzar, which was in 3389 with the handwriting on the wall. Those two parties are very closely related, and we'll talk about that momentarily. In 3407, Ahasuerus dies. Dariavesh, the son of Esther and Ahasuerus, becomes king. He is legally Jewish. He becomes king, although he was not a practicing Jew. And in 3408 is when the construction of the second temple resumes under the reign of Dariavesh. Everybody knew, the Jews knew, and even the non-Jews knew, that there was a very important prophecy The prophecy was said by the prophet Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, and it appears in Yirmiyahu Chaf Tes Yud, chapter 29, verse 10. And it says there that the Jews will be in Bavel and Babylonia ad malos leBavel shivim shana, until Babylonia will complete 70 years. Until 70 years of Babylonia, the Jews will be in exile. The clear implication of that prophecy was that after 70 years, the Jews would leave Babylonia and no longer be in exile. The non-Jewish kings were afraid of this prophecy, because the non-Jewish kings were aware of the history of the Jews. They were aware of our exodus from Egypt. They were aware of the splitting of the sea. They were aware of the conquest under Joshua of the land of Israel and the many miracles that took place. And the non-Jewish kings knew that the Jews had a special place with God. But then Nebuchadnezzar managed to defeat the Jews and destroy the temple. Now the question was, is God now forsaking the Jews permanently? Has God decided that they were my chosen people, but it's no longer the case, as many people would like to suggest today? Is that what God meant when he allowed Nebuchadnezzar to destroy the temple? Or was this simply a period of time where God was saying to the Jewish people, I'm putting you in a 70-year timeout, and when the timeout is over, then you may come out of your room and we'll be back together again? What was this? Was this a temporary thing or a permanent thing? Nobody knew. But when Yirmiyahu said 70 years, then that became the focal point. If at 70 years the Jews remained in exile, then that would prove that God had given up on the Jews forever. And of course, if after 70 years God took them out, then that would prove it was a temporary thing. So as much as the non-Jewish kings were in control of the Jews, and Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the first temple, and his children did not allow it to be rebuilt, but they were always nervous about one thing. There was one line that they wouldn't cross. And what is that line? They were afraid to use the utensils and the garments of the temple. They were scared, because who knew what was going to happen at the end of 70 years? And so the utensils, those sanctified utensils of the temple, and the clothing of the high priest, of the Kohen Gadol, all those things were squirreled away in treasure houses in Babylonia. And they were preserved for when that 70-year deadline would pass. Because if it would pass and nothing happened, then there was nothing to worry about. And the non-Jewish kings counted the 70 years. Now the language of the prophecy was 70 years that we will be filled for Babylonia 70 years. Sounds like when Babylonia as a great nation has 70 years, at that point, then God will take the Jews back. If you look at the timeline, the year that Nebuchadnezzar conquers Israel is in the year 3320. 70 years later is 3390. That's why they're in bold print. That was 70 years from when Babel had been filled with Israel, with having taken over Israel. It was 70 years later. Belshazzar, in the previous year, had counted 70 years. And he counted it out. And when he got to the third year of his reign, according to his calculation, which was wrong, the 70 years had elapsed. He thought it was over. We're now in the 71st year. He made a mistake. The Talmud discusses where his mistake was. It had to do with how they kept time in those days. That was a lot to do with it. But he made a mistake. That's why he took the utensils out and made a big party. That's the party of Belshazzar in the year 3389. And that's when the handwriting on the wall came about. The handwriting on the wall essentially said, no one was able to read it. Only Daniel was able to read it. We'll talk about why when we get to it this evening. But the handwriting on the wall essentially said, Belshazzar, you dared to use my utensils, you're finished. And that night, he was killed. And that's how the Persian Mede Empire then took over, conquered Babylonia, and became the ruling power in the world. Belshazzar miscounted. The actual count would have been the year 3390. And in 3390, in fact, Koresh the king allows the Jews to rebuild the temple. So there you go. The prophecy is fulfilled. And the Jews go back and they begin to build the temple. But then it stopped. The anti-Semites living around Jerusalem, they make it appear as if the Jews are trying to rebel, and they stop the whole thing. So it doesn't continue. At that time, Daniel can't understand what happened. Why did it stop? The 70 years are over. And it says in Daniel, in chapter 9, Daniel says, I investigated, I delved into the books, I went through the calculations, and I realized that that count of 70 years was correct, but only if we deserved it. And unfortunately, we didn't completely deserve it. That could have been the construction of the Second Temple. The exile could have ended in that year, 3390. But because we didn't deserve it, Daniel realized, therefore, the alternate 70 years was going to be used. Because 70 years for Babylonia is somewhat ambiguous. And it could mean one thing, it could mean another thing. Had we deserved it, it would have meant the first thing, which would have meant 3390 is the end of the exile. But because we didn't, therefore, the count will go, as Daniel writes, or is written about Daniel, in chapter 9 of Daniel, verse 2, it'll be until the destruction of Yerushalayim 70 years. Meaning 70 years from when Babylonia destroyed the temple, or it doesn't actually say that, it says Yerushalayim, that's when the actual construction of the second Beis HaMikdash will happen. If you look at the year the temple was destroyed, 3338, and look at the year that the construction of the second temple resumed, 3408, that is 70 years later. And that is when the 70 years were actually over. However, in the interim comes the Purim story. And in the Purim story, we have another would-be calculation of the 70 years. We have Achashverosh. Now Achashverosh said, I know what happened to Belshazzar. He counted the 70 years, and he counted wrong. And so he got this hand writing on his wall, and he got killed. But I'm a lot smarter than Belshazzar, and I know how to count the 70 years. And so Achashverosh counted the 70 years. He counted the 70 years from the destruction of Yerushalayim. The only thing is, Achashverosh got the wrong destruction of Yerushalayim. He counted from the exile of Yechaniah, from the first of the two exiles, 11 years prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple. He reasoned that 70 years of the destruction of Yerushalayim means when the first conquest of Yerushalayim took place and there was an exile, which was the exile of Yechaniah. He counted 70 years from then. Even with that, he was still off by a little bit. He made his party in the year 3396. Even according to his own calculation, it should have been the year 3397. But okay, that again has to do with how they kept time in those days. And as a result, he made a party in the third year of his reign. And that's how the Megillah starts on Purim. It says, Bishnas Shalosh Lamalcho, in the third year of his reign, Asa Mishelech Osarav Avadav. He made a big party. Why did he make a big party? For the same reason Belshazzar made his party. Because Achashverosh believed that the 70 years were up, the Jews were no longer the chosen people, God has forsaken the Jews, I have nothing to worry about. That's why he took the utensils out and used them and wore them at that party. And that is why, in the first chapter of the Megillah, when the reader gets to the words, in describing the opulence of the party, he gets to the words, V'chelim mikelim shonim, and there were utensils there, there were unusual utensils, he reads those three words with the Eicha tune, with that tune of mourning. Because those three words, utensils, that were unusual utensils, refers to the utensils of the temple that Achashverosh dared to take out and use because he felt the 70 years were over. The Talmud says that is essentially why Vashti was killed, even though, of course, when you read in the Megillah, it has to do with Achashverosh getting drunk and the whole business. But God brought that about because using those utensils has to result in a calamity. And it resulted in the death of Vashti. That's not a calamity for us, but a calamity for the person using the utensils. In fact, that then became the entryway for the eventual redemption. Because that's how Esther becomes queen, and it is eventually her son, with Achashverosh Daryavesh, who authorizes the rebuilding of the temple. So these 70 years frame the book of Daniel. This is the backdrop under in front of which Daniel was living. How long did Daniel live? We know that he's there at that first exile of Yechaniah. We know, as you see in your timeline, that he's still around for the handwriting of the wall in Belshazzar's day. He's in the lion's den that same year. And he is also, as I mentioned to you, he also does more calculations in the year 3390 to figure out the real count of the 7 years, or the actual count of the 7 years. When else do we find Daniel? Do we find him elsewhere in Scripture so that we can figure out how long he lived? Anybody know where else we find Daniel? He's in the Purim story. He's in the book of Nehemiah in a minute, but he's in the Purim story. Where is he in the Purim story? So we have a character in the Purim story named Hasach. Hasach is the person who is the go-between from Esther to Mordechai. When Esther's in the palace and Mordechai's outside the palace and they're not supposed to be in contact with each other because no one knows that she's Jewish, she uses Hasach as her agent to go to Mordechai, and he is the person who goes between them. Many commentaries understand Hasach is Daniel. It's the same person. And he's still there in the time of the Purim story. Some say that he was killed by Haman during the Purim story. Others say he continued on and lived throughout the Purim story, in which case it's not clear when he died. And he may have actually been there for the construction of the Second Temple. According to that opinion, Daniel may have actually spanned the entire 70 years from beginning to end. He's there the entire time. He's certainly there for the bulk of it. I was going to say the lion's share, but I didn't want to use the lion. So there we have our timeline, we have our backdrop for Daniel. So we know some famous things about the book of Daniel. We know there's handwriting on the wall. We know there's a lion's den. What else do we know about Daniel? Anybody have anything else they've ever heard about Daniel, about the book of Daniel?
Isn't there a fiery pit?
There's a fiery pit. Good. We have to talk about that. Fiery furnace. What else? Anybody know which mitzvos, which commandments is Daniel famous for risking his life to keep? Good. He risks his life to keep kosher. What else? And daily prayers. Good. He risks his life for prayer, for davening. Okay, we're going to see how that plays out as well. Daniel and his friends, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, are taken as young men in the exile of Yechoniah. They are dragged to Babylonia. They are by themselves. They do not have their family. They have each other. And they are in the king's court. They're being trained. They're being groomed to live in the court of the king. And I guess be those who would work in the court of the king. To work in the court of the king, especially Nebuchadnezzar, one had to be wise. One had to be have the correct manners, understand the workings of the political scene. One had to be a good-looking young man, and one had to be healthy. When Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were there, the servant of the king who was in charge of these young lads was responsible to make sure that they would be ready to serve the king when they got a little bit older. Part of that meant that he had to monitor their health so that he made sure that they were getting the right nutrition, the right exercise, etc., etc. The right nutrition meant eating the food that was prepared in the king's kitchen. And the king made sure that it would be the best foods, because only the best was appropriate for those who were being groomed to be in his court. But the best foods were not kosher. So Daniel decided, I'm not going to eat non-kosher food. I will eat only seeds, zeronim, only things that grow naturally from the ground. I will not eat anything prepared by the court of the king. The servant of the king who was in charge of the young lads came to Daniel and told him, you can't do this, because if you eat in a way that isn't nutritionally sound and you become scrawny, then the king is going to blame me, because I'm in charge of making sure that you are healthy. Healthy in those days meant you look healthy. And the king expects me to deliver healthy goods. So I can't let you do this. So Daniel said to him, look, I have to tell you, I don't want to be eating this stuff. It's against my religion. I'll tell you what. Give me and my friends a 10-day trial. I will only eat seeds for 10 days. You come back in 10 days and check me out. If I look scrawny, if I look emaciated, okay, then you win. But if I look healthy, if God takes care of me and He provides the nutrition for me, then you let me eat seeds. So the servant said, okay, I'm willing to give you a shot. Gave him 10 days. Daniel only ate seeds. He came back 10 days later, and as it says in Daniel, Daniel and his friends looked. What's that?
Sprouted.
Okay. He looked better. Sprouted. He looked better. Looked better fed than all of the other lads that were there. There were lads from other countries as well. And so he allowed Daniel to only eat seeds. And that was the first act that was a courageous act on the part of Daniel to make sure not to give up on a commandment. In this case, it was the commandment of keeping the laws of kosher. And throughout his time in the king's court, he never ate non-kosher food. He remained eating kosher food, even though there was no kosher kitchen. But he was able to maintain his laws of kosher. Eventually, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Dreams are a big part of the book of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar has dreams. Daniel has dreams. And a lot of the dreams are very difficult to understand, even after Daniel provides us with the interpretation. The interpretation needs several layers of interpretation. The first dream that we hear about is Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He has a dream. And he wakes up knowing that he had a dream, and knowing that this dream was prophetic, knowing that it was important, knowing that it wasn't just some something which some silly thing. He knew it. Problem is, he couldn't remember what he dreamt. Couldn't remember it. So he calls in all of his sorcerers, all of his stargazers, all of the wise men of Babylonia. And he says to them, okay, listen guys, I know you've given me some good things in the past, you guys are all wise people. I had a dream. I need it interpreted. And they say, sure king, go ahead. Tell us the dream. We'll tell you what it means. He says, well, there's a problem. I don't remember the dream. So they look at him and they say, well, alright, what do you want us to do? He says, well, you guys are wise men. You figure out my dream and then tell me what it means. So they say back to him, Nebuchadnezzar, no one can do that. That's impossible. There is not a human being on the face of the earth who can do that. So Nebuchadnezzar says, I don't believe you. And in fact, I'm going to make sure that you get it done. Because I'm warning you that if by tonight you are unable to give me my dream and its interpretation, you're all dead. That was the way Nebuchadnezzar generally ran things. So they were in a frenzy. What do we do now? And no one could know what to do. Eventually, the deadline passed, and the executioner started going around killing the wise men of Babylonia. As they were being systematically executed, Daniel was also among those who were sentenced to death because he was in the court. So he went to one of the higher-ups, and he said, what's going on? So he told them what was happening. So Daniel said, you know what? Give me a minute. We'll figure this out. So Daniel went, he got his three friends, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, and they locked themselves in a room, and they prayed to God. And when they prayed to God, then Hashem gave Daniel both the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had and its interpretation. Daniel came out, told those who are higher up, go tell Nebuchadnezzar, no problem, we got it. No one else has to be killed. They ran to Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel came before the king. Nebuchadnezzar asked him, well, what do you have to say? Daniel told him the dream. Nebuchadnezzar immediately remembered that that was in fact the dream, which of course impressed him to no end. And then Daniel continued to tell him what the dream meant. And because of this, Nebuchadnezzar was so impressed, he appointed Daniel as the head of the court of the king. Rather than just being in the court of the king, he appointed him the head of the court of the king. Daniel became a very powerful member of the political scene in Babylonia at a very, very young age. And the first thing Daniel did is he requested that his three friends, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, also become appointed to positions of prominence. And they were. And so, very quickly, upon reaching Babylonia, an episode happens that propels Daniel and his friends into leadership roles. And as we said, it is not coincidental, Daniel was the Jewish king in exile. Now, just to be clear, I don't mean he was actually the king. The king, Tzidkiyahu, had been killed, and the king, Yechoniah, was in a dungeon. Those are the actual kings. But Daniel was fit to be king, and he was the representation of the Davidic line in exile. Shortly thereafter is the story of the furnace. Now what happened here is, and I mentioned this story to you when we learned Yechezkel, because it has to do with the dry bones of Yechezkel, if you recall that class as well. Shortly thereafter, Nebuchadnezzar built a statue of himself. And the statue was huge, and the expectation was that when they would ring various instruments during the day, that would be a sign that you had to bow to the statue. And there were representatives of all the peoples that Nebuchadnezzar had conquered in the place with the statue, in the area where the statue was. And whenever those sounds would be heard, they all had to stop what they were doing and bow to the statue. Now, this statue was not an overt idol. It wasn't really an idolatry, which means we know that the mitzvot of the Torah, the commandments of the Torah, that typically when one's life is threatened and the choice is to give up one's life or to violate the Torah, we know the Torah says v'chai bahem, that we're supposed to live as we perform the mitzvot. And therefore, the mitzvot do not take preference over our lives. That's why if a person's life is at stake and it's Shabbos and they need to go to the hospital, we drive to the hospital. And that's why if a person's life is at stake and it means eating something non-kosher, then we eat something non-kosher. Because those mitzvot, as important as they are, do not supersede one's life. But there are three mitzvot that do supersede one's life. We know them to be idolatry, murder, and immorality. Idolatry would mean bowing down to an idol, that is meant to be a deity. Nebuchadnezzar's statue was not purely an idol. Had it been purely an idol, then there would have been no question that no Jew could bow down to it, even at the pain of death. And everybody knew that. But his statue was more a representation of him. One is allowed to bow to a human being. There's no prohibition to bow to a human being. The problem with bowing to Haman in the Purim story, some say the reason is because he had an idol around his neck, and others say it's because since Haman represented the destruction of the Jewish people, and he is a descendant of Amalek, that's why Mordechai wouldn't bow to him. But just a regular human king, it's permissible to bow to a human king. This is a statue representing a human king. It wasn't meant to represent some sort of god. Therefore, it wasn't so clear-cut that it was prohibited to bow to the statue. However, it wasn't in the spirit of the law to bow down to this statue, and since Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed the temple, it was really distasteful to bow to a statue of the man who had destroyed the temple of God. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were of the Jews who had been chosen to represent the people and bow to the statue. And they didn't want to do it. They asked Daniel if they should do it, if they should not bow. And Daniel said, listen, why don't you talk to the prophet, talk to Yechezkel, to Ezekiel. So they went down the block and knocked on Yechezkel's door, and they asked him, and he said that if you do it, you're going to be killed. You'll probably be killed. I can't tell you you'll be safe. God has not told me that you'll be okay. And he didn't give them a very satisfactory answer. He didn't give them an answer that would give them any sort of confidence. The punishment for not bowing down to this idol was to be thrown into a furnace. Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah left Yechezkel's house. And I mentioned to you when we learned the book of Yechezkel that after they left, God appeared to Yechezkel and said to Yechezkel, you think I'm going to forsake them? If they don't bow, I'm going to save their lives. But I didn't want you to tell them that, because I want them not to bow because they chose to, not because they think I'm going to save their lives. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah did not bow. They were thrown into the furnace and they came out alive. Not only did they come out alive, but while they were in the furnace was a pit in the ground with a huge fire. And while they were in there, you could look into the fire. Fire is not opaque. Those who could see were able to look into the fire, and they were able to see the three of them looking perfectly fine, looking like it was a stroll in the park. And when they came out, their clothing was not singed, their hair was not singed. They looked like they had just been to a spa. They looked perfectly fine. Nebuchadnezzar was astonished at this, and he therefore praised God, and he allowed Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah to not bow to this statue. That's the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. There is a little more to it, but I know we talked about it already in the book of Yechezkel. I'd rather not repeat what we've already spoken about. I'm sure you all remember that verbatim. Nebuchadnezzar has another dream. And this one is stranger than the first. I didn't tell you what the first dream was because you have to figure it out yourself. I didn't tell you what the first dream was because all the dreams in the book of Daniel are are difficult. The first dream is actually the easiest of all, and you're welcome to look in the book of Daniel to see it's in chapter 2 if you'd like to read it. It's in Aramaic, but you can read it in English, and it's interesting, and you can read Daniel's interpretation. But there's another dream that Nebuchadnezzar has, and in this dream Nebuchadnezzar, he calls Daniel in to interpret the dream, because Daniel is the man when you want to have a dream interpreted. So he calls Daniel in, and Daniel is afraid to tell him what it means, because it's not going to be very positive for Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar tells him, "Don't worry, I can take it." He didn't know what he was getting himself into. He said, "I can take it, go ahead, tell me the dream." So Daniel tells him that because of the way you have behaved, and you have not you've not treated the Jews properly, and you've not done what God wants you to do, therefore you, Nebuchadnezzar, are going to turn into an animal. You will become a beast of the field. You will actually become an animal. You will go on all fours. You will grow like fur, and you will not be able to speak, and you will eat grass of the field. You'll be an animal. So Nebuchadnezzar believed Daniel and said, "What do I do about it?" So Daniel told him, "I'll tell you what you can do about it. These Jews who are in exile, they're impoverished. They have nothing to eat. Take care of the Jews, because with tzedakah, with charity, that can withstand, that can hold back an evil decree." This is one of the places where we see that tzedakah is a powerful force that holds back evil decrees, even after a decree has been made. But charity, tzedakah, tends to hold it back. So Nebuchadnezzar listened to Daniel, and he began to feed the Jews. And as a result, for 12 months, the decree didn't happen. Nebuchadnezzar was fine. But as with all things, Nebuchadnezzar eventually got a little weak in it. Perhaps he started to have his doubts about whether it would actually happen. And at one point, he saw that his kingdom, his capital, needed his capital needed capital improvements, and he decided that too much money was being wasted on these poor Jews, and so he diverted the funds back into the coffers of his own kingdom. When he said to do that, immediately he began to turn into an animal, and he actually turned into an animal for 7 years. He was the beast of the field. It's a strange prophecy, but that is what is reported in the book of Daniel. Was the question? No question. Okay. As I mentioned to you, eventually Nebuchadnezzar dies. He's succeeded by Evil-Merodach, his son. Evil-Merodach dies, and he's succeeded by his brother or half-brother, Belshazzar. And Belshazzar counted the 70 years, miscounted the 70 years, made the big party. When he made the party, a hand appeared and wrote on the wall. It wrote on the wall. Does anybody here know what it wrote? Okay. It was Mana Mana Takala Farsin. It is in the book of Daniel. This is where it is. It says what happened. It is in chapter 5. It's in chapter 5. But they couldn't read it. No one there could read it. The non-Jews couldn't read it. The Jews couldn't read it. They couldn't read it. They did not know what it said. We only know what it says because Daniel was able to read it, so it's reported in the book of Daniel. Now, why couldn't they read it? So, I understand those who didn't know Hebrew perhaps couldn't read it if it was written in Hebrew, but there were people there who knew Hebrew or Aramaic. Why couldn't they read it? So, they couldn't read it for one of two reasons. A dispute in the Gemara why they couldn't read it. One opinion is that it was written in code. And there's various opinions within this opinion of what the code was. That what is it that Daniel figured out? It was written one way, and he figured it out another way. I once did I was once teaching a Mishnah class when I was living in Columbus. I had on Sunday mornings I had a Mishnah class for young boys. This was a seventh grade group, and I put up the words Mana Mana Taku Farsin, which is what Daniel figured out. I put that up in Hebrew on the board, And under it, I put each of the suggestions of what had originally appeared on the wall, and then Daniel figured it out. So I put down what was actually on the wall, and I asked them, so what was the code that Daniel was able to get from here to there? From this suggestion to mana mana taklo farsin. And there were four different possibilities in the Gemara, and I had the boys try to figure it out. They get successively harder in the Gemara, and the final one is a very complicated code, and I was sure none of the boys would get it. There was a boy there, I was very, very impressed, there was a boy there who figured out all four of them. He figured out what it would be. Now, that doesn't make him like Daniel, because Daniel did it without the benefit of the answer on the board. I gave them the question and the answer, just asking how you get from one to the other. Show the work. But there's still one of the seventh graders that was able to figure it out. It was very, very impressive. At any rate, that's one opinion, that it was in code. I was thinking that we would get a big board and put it up over here. That would be interesting. But okay, maybe next time. The other opinion is that the reason why no one could read it is because the Hebrew script was different than anything anybody knew. Why is that? Because the script that was being used at that time was Ksav Ivris. Ksav Ivris is not the script that you will find if you open a Torah scroll today and look inside of these block letters that we're used to. Those block letters are called Ksav. Ksav means the writing of Ashuris. Ashuris is the name of the type of writing that we have in the Torah today. There is an opinion in the Gemara that the Jews didn't have that writing. That the type of lettering they had was a different type of script. Ksav Ivris. And that in the time of Daniel, Daniel knew it, but others didn't know it. Now, why would Daniel know it? If they didn't have it, why would he know it? And the answer is because this special writing, which we have today, Ashuris, was the way that the original tablets were written. When Moshe came down from Har Sinai, from Mount Sinai, with the tablets, the first set of tablets, the tablets were written with Ksav Ashuris, with this special writing. But we know the first set of tablets didn't make it that long. Moshe came down and broke them. And therefore, the people didn't really get to study that lettering. The Gemara says that lettering is really the preferred lettering. It's the way it should be. But with the sin of the golden calf, we Jews were diminished in stature, and we were unable to be privileged to have that special alphabet. Instead, it's the same alphabet, but this special script. We were given a different script, the Ksav Ivris. And that's what we use throughout the years of Yehoshua and the conquest of Israel, the judges, the kings, the first temple, all the way until this time. But the great sages and the leaders of the people were taught this special writing, Ashuris, and it was taught from Rebbe to Talmud, from teacher to student, generation to generation. And Daniel, on the stature that he was, had learned it. Who taught it to him? I don't know. Did he learn it while he was still in Israel as a young lad? Did he learn it after he came to Babylonia? Maybe Yechezkel taught it to him. I don't know the answer. But he knew it. And therefore, when the new script came up, Ashuris, only he was able to read it. After Daniel's time, the Jews still continued to use Ivris, not Ashuris, until Ezra. Ezra, who is called Ezra HaSofer, Ezra the scribe, one of the major contributions of Ezra was that he made the Ashuris script the script of the Jewish people. And that's what we have in our Torah today. He was divinely inspired to tell the Jews that with the construction of the Second Temple, the time had come to use the higher level script rather than the lower level script. Belshazzar is killed. Belshazzar had that day had a battle with the Persian Mede Empire and had defeated them and came back and made this party at the end of the 70 years and took out the utensils of the temple. God then gave power back to the Persians and Medes. They came back with a counterattack, defeated Belshazzar and the Babylonian army, killed Belshazzar, and Darius the Mede becomes king over the known world. Dariush changed the political structure. He put in various advisors and various cabinet members that were not there in the time of his predecessors, the Babylonian kings. Dariush liked Daniel a lot. And therefore, Dariush appointed Daniel as the head of all of his advisors, all of his cabinet members. Those advisors and cabinet members were part of his ruling body before he conquered Babylonia. And then he conquers Babylonia, discovers within Babylonia this special Jew, Daniel, and appoints him as the head of the cabinet and the head of his advisors. His advisors and his cabinet members felt slighted. They felt that they had been pushed aside for this Jew who wasn't even part of the Persian Mede Empire. He was part of the defeated Babylonian Empire. And all of a sudden, comes along Dariush and puts him over everybody else. They didn't like that. And they resolved to get rid of Daniel. So how do you get rid of Daniel? Daniel is a pretty powerful guy. Well-liked, well-connected. Seems to have a pretty good connection with Hashem. How do you get rid of him? So the way you get rid of him is that you have to exploit his weaknesses. Well, what weaknesses does he have? So they discovered he has a significant weakness. And that is, he prays 3 times a day. So why is that a significant weakness? Because praying means asking God for something. What is the definition of prayer? So we know that prayer involves other things as well. Prayer involves praising God. Prayer involves thanking God. But the pure definition of prayer is asking God for something. If I say, Hashem, please give me a good day, that is a prayer. If I say, Hashem, please allow me to teach a class that is intelligible, that is a prayer. If I say to you at the dinner table, please pass the salt, that's a prayer. That's why the word can also be pray, pass the salt. That's a prayer. It is permitted for us Jews to pray to God, and it is permitted for us Jews to pray to people. You're allowed to pray to a person. You're allowed to say, please pass the salt. I can also say to you, please give me $100. I can also say to you, please give me $1 billion. Now that may be the most foolish thing I can possibly say, but there's nothing wrong with it. It's not heresy. There's nothing wrong with it. It's foolish, because you don't have the ability to give me $1 billion. So it's foolish for me to ask you for something that you can't do. But there's nothing wrong with me asking you to do things for me, which is praying. From God, He can do anything. So I can ask of Him anything. Please give me $1 billion. Right? There's nothing wrong with that, and that's not foolish, because God can do it. These advisors and cabinet members decided they're going to exploit this. And they went to Dariush and they said, listen, Dariush, you are now the king over the entire known world. That's a pretty lofty position. You didn't have that position until now. For this position, you need to have a special stature. And we believe that that stature needs to be that people have to realize that all goodness comes from you and nobody else. And therefore, no one should be allowed to pray to anything or anybody but you. No one should be allowed to ask anything of anybody but of you, because you're the king. And Dayavish agreed to this, and they wrote it in. And the punishment for going against this rule was being thrown into a pit of lions. So Daniel was in a bind, because now the king had said no praying, and Daniel wants to pray. He prays three times a day. So the Gemara says, the verse says in Daniel that he would then go home and pray in his house three times a day. Three times a day he would leave the court, go home, and close himself up in a room, open up windows towards Jerusalem. That's one of the places that we see you're supposed to pray towards Jerusalem. We pray east, because that's roughly the direction of Jerusalem. If you're living in Babylonia, you would pray west towards Jerusalem, which is what Daniel did. He opened up windows towards Jerusalem, and he prayed towards Jerusalem. But they knew this was happening. They knew that Daniel was praying, and they wanted to set him up. And so they accused him of prayer. They went to the king, they accused him of prayer. The king said, what do you mean? Daniel wouldn't disobey me. They said, no, he's disobeying. So, and we're going to prove it. We're going to call in Daniel at the beginning, at the midpoint of the day. Now, at the midpoint of the day, it's too early to begin davening mincha. So the afternoon service takes place from a little after the midpoint of the day until nightfall. That's the period of time you have to daven mincha. So he said, we're going to keep him here in front of us for those 5.5 hours, and let's see what happens. So Daniel was called in, and he remained there in the court in front of the king, in front of these people, for the next 5.5 hours. And as the clock was ticking away and it was getting later and later, the shadows were growing longer and longer, Daniel realizes he's getting stuck. It's getting to a point where he's not going to be able to pray. And finally, with just a few minutes left until sunset, Daniel said, I just got to do it. And he got up, and in front of everybody there, he prayed to God, thereby proving that they were correct, that he was disobeying the king, and now he has to be killed. He has to be thrown into the pit of lions. Dayavish was absolutely stricken by this. It killed him. Dayavish did not want to hurt Daniel at all. He loved having Daniel there. He respected Daniel. He felt that it was a feather in his cap to have Daniel in his court. And he was absolutely devastated. But he knew that because this was the law, and it was written in as the law, he could not violate it. Unlike Nebuchadnezzar, who wasn't bound by a book of laws, Nebuchadnezzar was able to do what he wanted, whenever he wanted, but Dayavish was bound by a book of laws. And this was now on the books, and he could not retract. And so they took Daniel and they threw him into the pit of lions. It was actually a pit in the ground. It was a hole in the ground with a bunch of hungry lions, and they threw him down into the hungry lions. Now we know they didn't touch him. They were fine. He was fine. Everything was good. They didn't touch him. But nobody knew that upstairs, because after they threw him into the pit of lions, they took a huge boulder, rolled it over the opening so that Daniel couldn't get out. So now he's in there in the pit, the boulder's on top, he can't get out. Daniel is fine. They don't know it. The whole night, Belshazzar can't sleep. He's going crazy. He can't deal with this. What's happening to Daniel? In the morning, he runs to the pit. He has the boulder rolled off, and he's crying out, Daniel, Daniel, did your God save you? Dayavish knew that perhaps God had saved him. Did your God save you? And after the boulder was rolled off, Daniel calls out, it's okay, I'm alright, no problem. Just pull me out, I'm okay. And Dayavish gives thanks to God, pulls Daniel out of the pit. And when he pulls Daniel out of the pit, he turns to the advisors that had gotten him thrown in there, and he says to them, alright, now it's your turn. And he takes those advisors, throws them into the pit. And the verse in Daniel reports that they didn't even reach the ground. They were still falling through the air when the lions ripped them to shreds. The lions were hungry. They hadn't eaten all night. They didn't eat dinner. Daniel was at dinner. They didn't eat him. They were starving. So as they fell through, the lions jumped up and began to rip them to shreds, and they were torn to pieces. That's the lion's den story of Daniel. It is not coincidental that Daniel is thrown into a den of lions. Why is that? He's from the Davidic line. And we know that Yehuda, where David comes from, is compared to a lion. And therefore, lions don't eat Daniel. Daniel is himself a lion. That is the analogy over there. The rest of the book of Daniel involves various dreams of Daniel himself, which are not easy to understand. Various interpretations are made of them, but they are prophetic in nature, and they involve the near future, both what's going to happen after the Persians and Medes are then defeated by the Greeks, and what's going to happen between the Greeks and the Romans, and going on in history as each successive nation is conquered by the other, and another nation takes control of the known world, going from the Babylonians to the Medes and Persians to the Greeks to the Romans. At the end of the book, there are a bunch of prophecies that are messianic in nature, and Daniel is not just prophesying about what will be in the time of the Mashiach, what will be in the future. But there are various verses in Daniel that actually state times, years that will pass, how much time will elapse when Mashiach will come. That secret of all secrets, the one that we all want to know, which is when is Mashiach coming? When are we going to be redeemed from this exile? That is written explicitly in the book of Daniel. But of course, when anything is written explicitly about this nature, it is veiled in all kinds of code and secrecy. And many of the commentaries try to figure it out. That's why you will get various predictions. When you hear a prediction about when Mashiach is going to come, or if there was in the past a prediction of Mashiach will come by a certain date, it almost always comes from the later chapters of the book of Daniel. It's another interpretation of how to read the cryptic pronouncements of Daniel. You are welcome to take a stab at it yourself. I wouldn't sell my house with that prediction, but you're certainly welcome to do so and see what you come up with. And you can read the various commentaries about it. But they all come from here. Most of the false Mashiachs that have come throughout the ages will be quoting things from Daniel and saying that this and this time is the time when Mashiach is supposed to come. Now, as I mentioned in the class that I taught on Daniel, in those series of classes I taught in the past, it is an interesting thing that we are constantly beset by false Mashiachs. False Mashiach is a regular thing in Jewish history. And predictions that fail are a regular thing in Jewish history. It's fascinating to me that there is even the notion of false predictions, because the Talmud tells us in Maseches Ksubos, in Tractate Ksubos, that there are various prohibitions concerning Mashiach. One of the prohibitions is you're not allowed to tell when he's going to come. That's one of the prohibitions. Now, if there's a prohibition that you're not allowed to tell when he's going to come, that means somebody must know. Because how can you have a prohibition not to tell if nobody knows? That means it's possible to figure it out. Someone's got to know. But even if you know, you can't tell. So all of these predictions that are out there, it's fascinating to me that people are willing to predict it and mention it, because it kind of is in itself a contradictory note, because you're not supposed to tell. So that's why it appears to me that when these predictions are being made, no one is saying that this is certain. This is definitely what's going to happen. No one is claiming to say that I know for certain when Mashiach is going to come. What they mean to say is that if you go through the verses, this seems to make sense. We know that Mashiach we are supposed to wait for Him every day. It's one of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, one of the 13 principles of faith, that we must wait for Mashiach. One of the things we're going to be asked after we pass away is Tzipisa LiYeshua. Did you hope for salvation? Did you wait for Mashiach to come? Every single one of us is going to be asked that question. And it's harder for us to fulfill that than it was for previous generations. And that's a good thing. The reason it's harder for us is because Jews, who unfortunately were being persecuted and were living in the depths of poverty, all they wanted was a fresh start. And therefore, hoping for Mashiach to come and save them was a relatively easy step. And most of those Jews of our predecessors were hoping for Mashiach on a daily basis, because Mashiach represented getting out of the terrible life they were living. That is also why it was so easy for the false Mashiach to be accepted. Because as soon as someone appeared on the scene who might actually be Mashiach, who seemed to have some of those qualities that would make him Mashiach, people wanted to believe in him. They really did, because it would change their lives, and their lives were terrible. For us, thank God, here in America, we live a much better life than they did before. And as a result, we get comfortable. We enjoy where we are, and we enjoy our lives. Everybody has tzaras. There's not a person on the face of the earth that doesn't have tzaras. But nevertheless, we also have a lot of good. And we can become complacent. And we are also going to be asked after 120 years, did you wait to be saved? Did you want to leave? It seems to me that the verses in Daniel are deliberately vague, not just because Hashem doesn't want us to know when it's going to happen, but because just as with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, it happened in stages, and just as with the construction of the Second Temple, it happened in stages, and just as the 70-year count, which was not veiled in secrecy, that was clear, it's 70 years. That's it. It's relatively short, and it's clear, there's no half numbers, it's 70 years. No secrets. But even then, there were various ways to count it. Do you count it from when Babylonia started? Do you count it from the first exile? Do you count it from the second exile? What about the fact that the way they kept time was a little bit funny? Whatever it is. But there were problems. People made mistakes. Belshazzar made a mistake. Achashverosh made a mistake. Daniel realized that the first way that they counted was correct, but they didn't deserve it, so you had to go to the second way to count. There were various ways of doing it. The same applies, I believe, to the coming of Mashiach. When you hear a date that Mashiach must come by, somebody makes a calculation. I'm not talking about somebody like me. I'm talking about somebody of great stature in the Jewish people makes a calculation. Mashiach is going to come by the year blank. 300 years ago. It's long gone. It passed a long time ago. So it didn't happen. He was wrong. I argue that he wasn't necessarily wrong. He made a calculation that may have been true. Just as the 70 years had various possibilities where it could have come true, the verses in Daniel that are shrouded in mystery have even more applications. And there are various years on the calendar throughout our exile which can fit the prophecy of Daniel. And those are the years that the predictions are about. And when we wait for those years and we say, oh, this could be it, it really can be it. But unfortunately, it hasn't happened yet. Just as the Jews in the time of Daniel, when the first count of 70 years was up, they were able to lay the foundation of the second temple, but then the rebuilding was stopped. And they had to wait for the next round because they didn't merit the rebuilding at that time. We too have gone through many, 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 many times that could have been Mashiach, but unfortunately, we didn't quite deserve it. And therefore, we're still waiting. And eventually, we will, please God, merit it, and that's when Mashiach will come. And somehow it will fit the predictions of Daniel. So Daniel, to sum it up, is the representation of the line of King David in exile. And he spans the exile of Babylonia from the beginning almost to the end, or possibly past the end. He is there on the scene of every piece of the exile, from Nebuchadnezzar to Belshazzar to Daryavesh to Koresh to Achashverosh, and perhaps even beyond. He's there. And he represents the Davidic line. He is constantly in a position of authority as a king should be. The Gemara tells us, as I started with, that Daniel could be Mashiach. He has the qualities and the qualifications to be Mashiach. Yes, he's no longer living, but if God is going to take Mashiach from those who have passed away, he is a prime candidate. That's who Daniel is. When we study the book of Daniel, which is all about the Babylonian exile, but not just being in exile, it's about the beginning, the middle, and the end of exile. It is also meant to be a study for the exile that we're in now. And just as Daniel can be the Mashiach, and the end of Daniel is all about Mashiach and the coming of Mashiach, when we study the book of Daniel, it is meant to bring up for ourselves Mashiach. It is something that we need to think about, something that we need to examine ourselves and say, are we waiting? Is this something that we really want? If someone steps forward and says, I have a prediction, and it's going to be at this time, yes, we're going to be skeptical. Of course we're going to be skeptical. But is it going to tug at our hearts? Are we going to say, I wish it will be true. I hope it will be true. I know it's probably not true because most of these predictions don't go well. But I really, really hope it will come true. Is that our reaction? Is that how we're feeling? That's what the book of Daniel challenges us to think and to say to ourselves. We should walk out of the study of the book of Daniel with a yearning for Mashiach, and to say to ourselves that may he come speedily and in our days. Amen.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.